This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today, we interview Dr. Thomas Moore, author of the new book, A Religion of One's Own, A Guide to Creating a Personal Spirituality in a Secular World. Thomas Moore was a monk for 12 years, also a university professor, musician, and psychotherapist. He's written several books, including the bestseller, Care of the Soul. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today, we interview Dr. Thomas Moore, author of the new book, A Religion of One's Own, A Guide to Creating a Personal Spirituality in a Secular World. Tom will join us in conversation for the hour, and here is Peter to give a more proper introduction of our guest today. Peter?
Our guest is Thomas Moore. He's an author of the new book, A Religion of One's Own. It's just been out a week. Thomas Moore was a monk for 12 years, a university professor, musician, psychotherapist. He's written several books, including a bestseller, Care of the Soul. He holds a Ph.D. in religion from Syracuse University. You also have a master's in theology and a master's in musicology from different campuses. So welcome, Tom, you said we can call you. So
please.
Welcome, Tom.
Thank you, Peter.
Thomas Moore, the book I really enjoyed reading, A Religion of One's Own. And just to start with, you define religion as the creative, concrete response to the mysteries of life. So tell us what you mean. What are the mysteries of life? And expand on that a bit.
Well, I suppose I should say first that I'm interested in mystery. I mean, that's how I understand my background in the study of religion. I'm interested in mysteries. I want to preserve mysteries. I'm not interested in solving them, you know, and figuring them all out. I think religion's about acknowledging that there are things we don't know and that will never be known and shouldn't be known. But we have to deal with them in some way. The most obvious one would be our mortality. You know, how do you deal with death, and how do you think about it, and what do you think about the shortness of life, and about afterlife, and if there is such a thing? You know, people have talked about afterlife forever, so I mean, if I can put it that way. And that's some mystery. There are other mysteries. I think getting sick, getting really seriously ill is a great mystery. We don't treat it that way. We treat it as a physical problem. But in fact, when you talk about the experience of it, I've been visiting a lot of hospitals in the past few years and talked to patients, and they don't know what's happening. Where did this illness come from? You know, why me? These are mysterious things, you know, and having to do with fate. And you try. A lot of people try so hard to keep healthy. And a lot of times these are the very ones that get struck by some illness. So you say, well, what is that? There's the mystery of why in the world am I living with this person I'm with? That's quite a mystery. We don't think of it that way. We often think of relationships and marriages and partnerships as situations that are psychological or sociological or something, but they're also mysterious. You get a group of people together and talk about how they met, and you hear all these stories of weird things that happen to draw them together. So there are a lot of mysteries in life, and I think religion is mainly about finding a way of responding to those.
You talked about the soul. And as felt vitality, a full presence, a depth of things. And tell us what you mean by soul. You wrote the book Care for the Soul.
Right.
And certainly your book, A Religion of Your Own, is soulful. So tell us what you mean by that.
Well, I like a description of soul that's not too fancy, not too abstract. You know, you can get into that. A lot of people have these huge definitions that are very esoteric. But what I like to say about soul is, you know, what happens when you meet somebody that you feel you can really talk to, that you'd like to have dinner with? What's going on there? You're meeting someone maybe who has really lived life, who has a little depth, is not shallow, is not just operating out of their mind. So they have some, you might say heart in that case. Heart and soul often go together in that particular way. So I would define soul as the depth of our feeling, depth of our thoughts, depth of our relationships, deep memories. Put all that together, and it makes you a human being.
Tom, this book covers a lot of ground in terms of concepts of spirituality. And so let's put this out at the beginning here of the show. juxtaposing your talk of the soul and spirituality. When many people in our culture hear some of these terms, they also equate that with religion. Specifically, mm-hmm. and meaning institutional or organized religion. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about some of the differentiation that you're clearly making?
I've had a life in religion. It's like I haven't chosen it, but it just happened to me. I became a monk when I was 13. I mean, I went off to a Catholic religious order, which in the life there, even in high school, was totally monastic. And I lived that for 13 years, and then I got a PhD in religion. Got interested in depth psychology, Jung, and I was a very good friend of James Hillman, who was a kind of a renegade Jungian. I guess what I'm saying is that I have a real interest in and love of the religious traditions, but I know that they're full of problems. And in a way, the way I see it, the religious institutions have stood in the way of religion in a deep sense. So what I'm trying to do in this book is redefine or reimagine religion, take away all that weight that has really made a mess of it in some ways, and say, what's beneath it all? And so that's when I start with the individual experience. I don't mean to limit it to that. I mean, you know, you want to have a community and friends and be concerned about the world and have an ethical life. But religion itself, as I look at it, would be an experience, a way of being in the world. It's a way of being in the world where you don't live a fully secular life and you don't explain everything. And you, because of, well, you, as I say in the book, you have some mystical experiences, you know, you kind of reach out beyond the known. Your sense of self expands through that kind of experience. It leads to a very heightened sense of ethics and justice, that kind of thing. And so you end up, in a way, having a religion that is based on your own experience of it. And if you want to go to church, or go to a synagogue or something like that, that's great because you may get some support and some ideas, but it's not necessary. And I would recommend, if you're going to do that, it's a good idea to also build your spiritual life by knowing something substantial about other traditions as well.
So you will talk about, or you take from, perhaps, all of the religious traditions that we're aware of.
All of them, yes.
What are some of the favorite things that really are inspirational for you?
Well, the first thing that would come to my mind would be the Tao Te Ching from China. That really guides me a lot. It's simple, not easy to understand, but simply stated. And it's mainly, I guess mainly the thing I draw from it is that little effort goes a long way. Or you can even say that, you know, as they say, doing nothing, you can accomplish a lot. So, and yielding is strength, that kind of thing. So that philosophy, to me, is at the base of my own personal religion. The Tao Te Ching is essential to it. Now, we've also studied Greek polytheism. And we call it Greek mythology, but that's not a good word for it, because these are the stories of the gods and goddesses of a real religion where people honored the gods and goddesses and temples and prayed as devoutly as anyone in a church today would. So I see that spirituality as being very rich. It's polytheistic, and that means that in that kind of a religion, you can see the sacredness in everything, every part of life. You don't just try to find this, you know, your secular life and then there's your religious life. Everything is religious to a polytheist. So I think that's an advantage, and we can learn a lot from that, and we can adapt it to ourselves. You don't have to become a polytheist. I don't even know what that would be like today, but you can certainly take that philosophy to heart and make it a piece of what you're doing.
Something like there's a sacredness in all things.
In all things. But, I mean, even things you least expect, like there's a sacredness about money. There's a God for that. You know, there's a, for the Greeks. There's a sacredness about nature, about the natural world. And in some monotheistic religions, they really don't like you to find sacredness in nature. That sounds pagan. So I think taking on and being educated by the polytheistic religions helps in a very important ways to reclaim places that have been secularized.
We're speaking with Thomas More, author most recently of A Religion of One's Own. You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Tom, your background is eclectic. You spent time in the monastery. You spent time in the university. Also a musician. This is the connection here. You've had an eclectic background, and you have this very open, sort of expansive view on religion, spirituality. Hardly accidental, then, at least in that case. You know, what muse has guided you, do you think, throughout your time? Or which muses have guided you? Uh-huh. Because there's this connection. You have this eclectic background. You have these varied interests. You have and then you have this very this very broad and expansive way of sort of not just understanding the world, but basically the universe from the macro to the micro, right, from the outer to the inner. Uh-huh. So what things have influenced you, do you think, along the way?
Well, an awful lot of people, living and dead, influenced me. I think probably the first figure that really began to get my thinking to broaden it was Teilhard de Chardin when I was in the Catholic religious order. Chardin was a scientist and a very devout priest, a theologian of sorts, but he developed a theory that evolution included the development of the spiritual life of the human being, and he saw that we were going to evolve not just physically, but spiritually as well. And I was really taken up by that. When I read him now, I find him different from when I was reading him in my 20s. He seems a little more pious than he did to me then, but still his vision is fantastic. The next person I ran into was Paul Tillich, who was a Lutheran theologian at the University of Chicago and very influential to a lot of people. I met him just once. And he wrote about the theology of culture. He was interested in finding language that wasn't pious and wasn't too limited to describe what religion was like. And his main phrase was ultimate concern. He said he thought that religion was about your ultimate concern. Well, I put that together with Chardin, and I began moving in these directions that were away from traditional language, and I think an opening up of what divinity means, what God means, what theology is about. So today, I call myself a theologian today, but I have no connection to any religion, any formal religion at all. But I figure that just exploring these same questions that the religions have done, in my own language that is more secular maybe, that I'm a theologian because I'm doing that. And I think there's a real need for that theological thinking today, although that saying that is, would be gibberish.
Would you call yourself then a religious humanist?
I would, definitely. I've called myself that for most of my life.
So you're in that tradition.
I am, definitely. Yeah. You know, one of my models in that was Thomas More of England. Thomas More was a religious humanist, and yeah, I'm much in that spirit.
Good, good. In one sense, too, this is fairly radical, in that if you're looking at the word radical, meaning going back to the roots of mm-hmm. issues,
right.
Finding a religion of one's own, being in a process of developing that throughout your life, recognizing soul as a felt vitality within ourselves and in the world, that's fairly radical.
It's not, it's certainly in the mainstream of thinking, that's for sure. But, it's radical, but it's radical in relation to modernistic thinking. It's not radical when you go back in time. I mean, in previous centuries, let's say, it wouldn't have been quite so radical because people were still able to think theologically. Maybe they were. We have the advantage that we have so many traditions available to us really clearly. But, this book, this reminds me, this book of mine, this one started out as a book on the Transcendentalists of New England. I live in New Hampshire, and I feel their presence pretty strongly. And I started up with them because I thought that what they were doing is very similar to what I'm trying to do now. And they found the formal religions to be inadequate. I mean, people like Emerson and Thoreau, Emily Dickinson, they found them to be inadequate. And they didn't just become secularist. They said, okay, I'll just do it my way. So Emerson just started wearing these black suits and he'd go out get lecturing. It looked like he was just giving public lectures at public places, but actually it was his own religion. And if you read him and read his notebooks and letters and things, you see that was his religion. He was not doing a secular lecturing job. And Thoreau the same way. He's very explicit about the connection between what he did in his life, building a cabin and his canoes and all that, and the religions, including Christianity and Eastern religions and Neoplatonism and all that. So what I'm doing, I think, is very similar to the Transcendentalists.
We're speaking with Thomas More, author of A Religion of One's Own. Tom, who do you see today? Obviously, you're saying that you have a connection to Transcendentalists. Who else do you see today? Who inspires you today in maybe this kind of both thinking, thought, and action?
Mm-hmm. Well, one person that has been very important to me in his thinking is John Dominic Crossan. I don't know if you know about him. He's a New Testament scholar. He happened to be in the same religious order I was in, and I studied with him, New Testament with him when I was in school then. And what he has done has helped me to see a Christian theology and the Gospels in a way that's very similar to the Transcendentalists, as far as I can see. So the very idea of who Jesus was and what he was up to. Jesus is an important figure for me. A few years ago, I translated the Gospels from Greek myself to get my own take on it. And the Jesus that emerges from that close study of the Gospels is entirely different from the one you get in popular culture. So that's an interesting piece in my development, to be able to see my own background in really in fresh ways.
Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. The Jesus I see is someone who had a utopian vision. He felt that we could reach a different level of existence. We could get away from the emphasis on authority and control of people, and instead institute this society that was based on what he called agape. The best translation, I think, for that is mutual respect. It's not about a kind of a gushing romantic love. It's not a sentimental love or anything like that that you sometimes get, you know, about Jesus. It's not that. I think it's really, and this is Crossan's point too, I think, that this was Jesus was a figure who was trying to change the culture, trying to shift to a different way of dealing with people, radically different, utopian. So that, you know, we can imagine a way of life that's really different. I think the kind of world that you guys are working toward, you know what I mean? That whatever vision you have, because you're working hard toward it, that's what Jesus was doing. It was not the sentimental stuff that we hear about so much. And there's no moralism in it. You know, he's not a moralistic figure at all. And yet the religions have, in his name especially, have been just riddled with moralism, and that's been a great weakness.
Well, ironically, it's also such that institutionalized religions, I mean, in this case it would be Christianity, but you could say similar things about others, they've become incredibly authoritarian, moralistic, in fact, the opposite things of what you just described.
That's right. Well, my take on that is that it goes back to this idea of soul. I make a distinction in my work by following Hillman and Jung and other people between soul and spirit. Soul is this deep thing that makes us human, as I said before. It's this capacity to be able to allow life to be connected to life, to appreciate life, to be in touch with your past and be attached to things of the world and the people, certain people and all that kind of thing. That's all the soul. It makes us very human. Spirit takes us out. It's important. It takes us out beyond ourselves. You think of the cosmos and being creative and changing the world, all these big things. It doesn't really make you human. It gives you kind of a transcendent point of view. Now, that sounds great, but it has a shadow side. And the shadow side of being so transcendent is that you lose touch with that sense of intimacy and connection and empathy for people and all that kind of thing. So I think that it's not just that the institutions have messed things up that way. It's that any time we try to create a spiritual community or a spiritual program, we run the risk of losing touch with soul because we get so far out in that spiritual realm. So my point always is to connect spirit and soul, be human and transcendent at the same time.
So that puts God in the context of the infinite.
Yes, absolutely. The unknowable, the unsayable, yeah. The hidden God, Deus absconditus, the God you can't name and can't see, but you still give a place for that. Whether you use the name God or not, you know, that's not really the issue.
So atheists are welcome to have a religion of their own.
Absolutely. I was thinking of atheists and agnostics every page I wrote here. I said they are the best candidates in a way because they don't have some of that stuff in the way. Some of them do. They have their own ideology in the way, but generally speaking, yes, they're good candidates.
You make a lot of the parable of the Good Samaritan, and that's acting out in the world, action. How do you see activism for human betterment as part of religion?
Well, as I said, I think that once you have developed this religion of your own, which is real, not a passive thing where you just submit to some group or some established thinking, but you really deepen your heart, you know, and in your head you have a view of the world that gives you a purpose in life, then I think automatically if you are developing that, you develop empathy with the people around you. And one of the things I'm saying these days, people are always asking me, a religion of your own, where's community in that? Well, I say that the community will be different from getting like-minded people into the same building. I think what you'll find is that you'll have more empathy for people that you're not connected to, you don't know, a sense of a world community much more. And I think that's the motivation for activism. You know, if you don't have that grounding, I don't know what the activism is, really. But at the same time, if I may add to that, when I'm around activists, I always call myself an inactivist because I don't have that spirit of activism in me in a kind of overt way. I think my books are, you know, you say the ideas are radical. I feel that too. But I don't present myself as a radical or as an activist. I try to present myself as just someone reflecting on these things, and I hope that I can seed ideas without actually being too active myself.
Well, wouldn't we say, even for those of us who are radically active in the community, that this is a spiritual path, a religious path?
Oh, absolutely it is.
Okay.
Absolutely.
All right.
We're speaking with Dr. Thomas Moore, A Religion of One's Own, and after this brief musical break, we'll come back and continue our discussion with Tom. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today's program for the hour, we're joined by Thomas Moore, author of A Religion of One's Own, A Guide to Creating a Personal Spirituality in a Secular World. And before the musical break, we were talking about activism. And now we're going to switch gears and talk a little bit more about what else is in this book. And this book is just out recently. So you can, those of you that are interested, can check out your local independent bookstore and get a copy of that if you want to see it more in depth, what we're talking about today. Peter?
Part of what you talk about in here is relationships and living an erotic lifestyle. Tell us what you mean by that.
I wanted to include this, as I do in most of my books, the idea of eros, because it seems to me, especially with religion, that we've reached a point where formal religion has pretty much identified itself as against the erotic life or against sexuality. And there seems, I think probably most people would think that there's an antagonism between these two things. The churches are always telling us how to limit our life. They hardly get much support, you know, in our sexual experiences and experimentations and all of that, our conflicts. So I think it's important then, if you really want to have this deep, unfettered sense of religiousness within yourself, that you've got to reconcile your spirituality with your sexuality. And the way I would recommend doing that is to appreciate that sex is not just about sexual behavior. Sex reaches much further. I'm kind of Freudian in this regard. I tend to think that sex really has to do with being alive, feeling vital, being creative. It's engaged in all of these things. And so it's much closer to religion than we think. It's not really at the opposite end. It's very, very similar, very close to religion. It's very close to our creativity. It has a lot to do with not being depressed. A lot of people are talking about wanting a purpose in life. Well, part of finding the purpose is to find out what pleases you, what's pleasurable, and that's a sexual issue, seems to me. So we have to be comfortable with our sexuality in order to be religious.
A religion of your own is very pleasurable.
That's what I would say. I would put those two words together constantly. So, yes.
Not just physically pleasurable, too, but emotionally as well.
Emotionally pleasurable and pleasurable in so many ways. Just the pleasure here. How about the pleasures of the mystical experience, of being free of your own ego for a little while, if only for a few seconds? That's a pleasure. The pleasure of meeting people with whom you can share some really deep conversation about purpose in life and about what you're doing. That would be pleasurable. And they're just one after another, pleasures in the religious life. But, you know, would the average person think that? I don't think so. We tend to think of religion and pain, or religion and repression. And we've got to get over that, because that's the inherent masochism in formal religion. It's a danger in spiritual life generally, because a lot of people think the more they suffer, the better they are as people. I'd like to reverse that.
So kneeling on your knees and praying a long rosary and feeling physical pain in the process of doing that isn't necessarily what you're talking about.
It's not what I'm talking about. In fact, that could be masochistic pleasure. I'm not saying the rosary would not give you real pleasure. It could. But yeah, if you're suffering physically or in some other way and thinking this is a good thing, even to the point of enjoying it, that's not very good.
I want to ask you about evil and how really awful, terrible events that happen in the world, perpetrated by people who are just lack humanity in any sense. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with that? How do you think about that?
Well, you know, I'm a psychotherapist. You know, I do work even today. I don't do a lot of it, but I do. I work with a few people, and it's very intense, very deep work. So I encounter shadow, the dark, the evil, in different ways frequently. I also, by the way, teach psychiatrists a lot. I teach three or four times a year. For a week at a time, I teach psychiatrists. So I have developed this, you know, a certain empathy for the perpetrators of evil acts. I don't mean to say that in any way that I want that to continue or that I feel good about these people. But working with psychiatrists, one of the things we have to do is say to that professional, can you work with someone who perpetrates really things that you consider absolutely evil? Can you work with child molesters or with murderers? Can you do that? Can you acknowledge that there's stuff going on, things going on that lead people to this kind of behavior instead of just branding someone evil? So that's, you know, maybe my perspective. I know my perspective is colored by that, by being a therapist, where I have to be able within myself to say that this human being who is doing these evil things is someone I can still be with and talk to and try to see if there's some way toward being, for that person to be liberated from where they are. Especially, it's easier to see, of course, someone like we see these crazy people that go into the schools and shoot. That is obviously crazy, and it's not easy to work with. It takes a special person to be able to work with someone who's doing that kind of thing. But what that does for me, it places evil in a certain relative context. I have to see the conditions where that evil comes from, and that's what I want to go after and do something about.
So, Tom, speaking of then the shadow side, we're approaching Martin Luther King Day. And in the 60s, King, of course, among the many, many, many things that King said, and King certainly had a radical side, to him, certainly opposed to oppression, classism, racism, and militarism, right? And one of the things that he said was, a nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual doom. Are we there yet?
We passed that line long ago, as far as I can see. And we don't realize what that does to us as a nation, that we seem blind to the ethical issues, and that our ethics is so broad or has no subtlety, so that we don't see a lot of the things we do as evil. The same could be said of our relationship to the planet, what we're doing to the planet. That could be seen as just a kind of an ethical blindness. And I think it comes in part from our spiritual naivete, that we don't develop a depth of spiritual life, of our spiritual life. We don't let it suffuse everything we do. That's one advantage of this religion of your own. That religion's everywhere in everything you do. And socially, what we do is we think there's formal religion that takes care of it. You go to church, you're okay. Then you kind of do what you want, the rest of the time, the other days of the week. And that kind of religiousness just doesn't work. It's, in fact, if anything, it justifies and promotes this kind of ethical questionable behavior.
Do you think, Tom, that, again, that seems to be one of the purposes behind that, maybe not like something that you sat down and consciously thought of as I'm going to write this book because, right? But certainly it seems that one of the issues that come out of this is that if more people maybe glommed onto this and became part of a community having this kind of a dialogue and transcended the more traditional top-down authoritarian views of things like religion or other social cultural institutions, do you think that people tend toward thinking in this way and having these kind of beliefs anyway, and they just don't have an outlet or a place for this to go?
Not only that they don't have an outlet, but I don't think they have the language and the ideas in order to make it happen. People need support. You need someone to help you with articulating and sorting all. It needs a lot of sorting out. So I do think people have an impulse. I hear it all the time in my travels. People tell me that they are, so many people tell me that they are not able to go back to their formal religious, background. But they don't want to be secularists either. They want something in there. So they'll grab onto kind of a vague spirituality. But that's nothing. That doesn't really shape their lives too much. So, yes, I think one of my purposes in writing this book is to, as someone who's had the leisure to be able to study these things as a theologian of culture, theologian of the world, to be able to study these things, to offer some sorting of all that material, to sort it and give a language to it.
And giving a language to it, too, would that be, you could consider it music, art, expression, I mean, not just verbal language, what do you think about other types of communicating or expression?
I make a big deal of the place of art in this book and other intuitive forms of knowing. So absolutely. That's the whole point. A secular world is kind of condemned to only think rationally about everything and to think mechanistically largely about almost everything that it touches. What I'm recommending here is, if you really want to get into this realm, and you just get it from the spiritual traditions, that you need a kind of spiritual poetry. You need a real sensitivity to the symbolic, to the profound, to the archetypal, to the mythic, to language of mystery, and to other arts. Like, to me, music is really, for me, music would be the most effective. So when people ask me what my practice is, my meditation, I tell them it's playing the piano. And I mean that because but I think it requires your intention and it needs some regularity and cultivation.
It always was for me. That's why I gravitated toward that. I used to play, 8 hours a day kind of thing. You just kind of get lost.
You get lost. See, that's the point. You get lost. And the purpose of the mysticism is to get lost. To get lost in a good way, not to get lost in a psychotic way.
I'd like to get lost more often.
Yeah, well, you should. See, the traditions teach us that the soul needs to get lost regularly. It needs it. This is not my idea. This has been around for thousands of years. The soul needs to get lost. The Latin word for it in the Old Text is vacatio, like vacation. It needs to take a vacation. But they mean the kind of just getting away from the, you know, from that narrow life of the ego, to get away from that. So you lose yourself in a positive way. I can do that best playing the piano. Other people do it differently. My wife paints. Friends who write poetry.
Or people can do yoga or whatever
yoga,
gives you that
yoga,
space.
Walks in nature, go out sailing. I mean, you know, lots of ways to do it.
Pet your dog.
You know, spend some time with your kids. I've heard that too. People say a moment with their children. And this is another point about mysticism. It can last only 10 seconds, and that's your vacation. You know, I'm not talking about taking several hours of your day out for this. It can only be a matter of a very short time, and it does something to your being.
Wow. Talk about how dreams fit into a religion of your own.
In this book, I didn't want to get into too much into the work with dreams, how to deal with dreams. People are interested in that, but that's a psychological issue. I didn't want to go explore too much. I do it a little bit. But what I wanted to emphasize is something I'm really learning in recent years. Working with people with their dreams so intensely. I've done that for 30 years, but in the past 5 or 6 years especially, I've been working with people where the dreams take us to the so deep into the narrative that they're living out that I think the dream work is really a spiritual practice and belongs in the practice of one's own religion, the dream work. And most of these things I like to relate to the traditional religions too. And we have a lot of examples in the formal religions of dream work being a part of the practice. What it does, it takes you to the place in image, by the way, and not in thought, not in rational thought, but in image. It takes you to the very roots of who you are, of what's being lived through you. What stories are actually living themselves out in your ordinary surface stories? Like, oh, here's the surface story. I just lost my job, and this is how I feel. You explore that a little bit and look at your dreams from that time when you're losing your job. You will find some deep level of narrative going on that not only relates to this losing your job, but relates to something that happened maybe 10 years ago, which relates to something that happened in your childhood and so on. So you see that there's this stratum in your existence that's timeless, that circular, keeps repeating. And then you just discover slowly really who you are at a very deep level.
You had a really interesting quote from John Cage at the beginning of the part of your book on a poetic life. I ran across and it resonated, and it also really tied into what we were just talking about a few minutes ago. Cage said, "Thoreau got up each morning and walked to the woods as though he had never been where he was going to, so that whatever was there came to him like liquid into an empty glass."
Pretty good.
that was a pretty good... It certainly introduces that segment of the book. And a lot of things, again, a lot of territory covered in the book. We're speaking with Thomas Moore. His new book is A Religion of One's Own, A Guide to Creating a Personal Spirituality in a Secular World. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Toward the end of the book, we at Project Censored know a lot about lists. We have our top 25 stories. Americans seem to love lists, top 10 lists, this and so forth. And lists, I guess, are a way of sort of the way we organize things or sort of lay things out. Maybe part of that rational or mechanistic part of the brain that you were talking about we need to take vacations from sometimes.
I don't know. It may be a form of poetry.
In fact, yes. Here you have a final list at the end of your book, and I think you're kind of wrapping up what you're trying to get across here. So I just thought maybe we should talk about a few of these for folks as we have about 6-odd minutes left, something like that. So maybe we could talk about some of these. You start, of course, by saying redefine traditional terms and ideas. And don't be too literal about community. What do you mean by that?
I mean, that we just what I was saying a little bit before, that when we literalize community, we think of these bodies in a particular location. You know, like when people go to church, there are these bodies, and they say, oh, this is our community. I think it's a bit literal. There's another way of looking at community is that there are many people I've never met, I don't know, but they're part of a community because we are aiming for the same goals, or maybe just because we're human beings, maybe just because we happen to be objects on the planet, so that the community might include animals, but also human-made things, like, you know, objects. And I like myself, this is a really big, I really want to push it. I'm interested in the extraterrestrial community, too, so that we think about the people we haven't encountered. I'd like to have a really big vision of what community is.
You also, you go on and say here that, and this is a little bit recapping some things you said earlier, feel you have a right to learn from and practice anything from the world's spiritual and religious traditions. And then you say, understand that many things, if not everything, that are usually considered secular are sacred if you have the eyes to see it. So, you're big tent here. You're putting it all together. And so, in other words, you're saying that one specific example could be, what can non-Christians learn from Jesus, you know, for example.
Oh, so, yeah.
And, of course, what you were saying earlier is quite a bit, if we have the eyes to see it.
That's right. And if you take down those barriers, stop thinking of the traditions, these spiritual traditions, as belonging to anybody, you know, and that there's some sort of conflict between them. You know, that doesn't have to be. These, you know, they're all available. And if someone wants to tell you that that Buddhism is, if you had to, should be a Buddhist if you really want to know Buddhism, well, you can tell them, look, this belongs to the world. The Buddha is for everybody. He's not for Buddhists. And Jesus is not for Christians. He said that as clearly as possibly could be. And so that's kind of an old way of thinking. We need to get those, tear down those fences completely. And life would be different.
So studying the Quran or...
Absolutely.
Or the Kabbalah?
Or all of it.
All of this fits right into what you're talking about.
It all fits in. And, you know, some people complain because then they always say, well, that's the cafeteria approach and it's superficial. Mm-hmm. Doesn't have to be. Another thing I advocate is study. I have a chapter in here about applying the monk's life to our ordinary situation. It's another place to draw from. And monks were very, very dedicated to study, to collecting books, to translating, to copying books out. So I think that we can get over this cafeteria criticism because we can really take a piece of another religion and study it where we might know it better than the people who are actually members of that particular group.
And, of course, you also talk about being a mystic in your own ways. And, again, that ties into arts. We had already spoken a little bit about arts and spiritual education and welfare. So, again, we're integrating all these. And the list here at the end of your book obviously really just sums up what you're trying to get at in this new book called A Religion of One's Own.
Yeah, I think the list helps because, you know, like I said before, I want to help people sort all of these things out. And with a lot of, you know, language, you know, and going through all these details, at the end, I think it's good to sort it and just put it in the list form. And I like that. Just make an outline and say, okay, now I get it. Now I can see it. And I can apply this.
And your life in the monastery, one would think that that is the opposite of the cafeteria approach, the metaphor you used.
I'd call it the opposite, yeah.
Right. So that's obviously influenced you, and it's influenced you to study very seriously about these many, many things. So there is a great discipline there.
There's a discipline. Like I say, you know, when I write my books, I read Latin and Greek, you know, to get through them. I don't just write off the top of my head. I trust tradition. I trust the past more than I do the present in that regard. So, I think that a discipline of thought, a discipline of also of expression. I really try to find language that will not be just too simple, too easy, and yet not be too technical either. You know, I really try to find language that will be beautiful enough and pleasurable enough that we'll want to pursue this.
Well, you certainly had a great deal of praise and recognition of your work over the years. Here, Larry Doocy saying Thomas More is an authentic example of a new kind of therapist, a doctor of the soul, which in our century has been in short supply. So it seems like that this is something that people could really use in their daily lives.
Yes, absolutely. And to the point where any of us could become doctors of soul.
Tom, anything else you want to – we have about 30 seconds to wrap up our program today. Anything you want to leave people with?
The one word that sticks out for me is pleasure, that Peter brought up. That's the key for me. If we can do this, so we can read this book and maybe follow our own way in there and do it for pleasure rather than pain, we'd be many steps ahead, and I think we'd be a less violent people.
Thomas More, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to join us today on the Project Censored Show. It has been a pleasure.
It's been fun.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show. We originate out of KPFA Studios in Berkeley, California, but we are on in WBAI. We're on in New York. We're on in Washington, D.C. We're on around the United States. So I'd like to give a shout out to all of our listeners there. Thanks to Anthony Fest and Kirsten Thomas. See you next time.